Welcome to another episode of the Poetically Yours Extended Podcast. I'm Yvonne Booz. This podcast is an extension of the weekly Poetically Yours segment. This month's feature artist is Don Hennigan. Hennigan published City Lights Pocket Poet Series 1955 through 2005 and his latest City Lights Pocket Poet Series 2005 through 2025. In this episode, he talks about the poets and his latest book, his path to poetry, and shares some of his own creations. Take a listen. All right, Don, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Well, thank you for having me. As I said, it's an honor to be part of your podcast. So
before we get started, I know you have a book that you want to tell me about. But before we talk about that book, I want to just talk about your journey as a poet. I did listen to an interview that you did. I think it was recently with the Rockford Public Library. And you were talking about how at first you weren't too interested in poetry when you were in school, but then you got a hold of some books that piqued your interest. Tell me about that.
Sure. It's like I said, I came to poetry probably the long way around. In high school and in college, undergraduate, you write a few poems and, you know, they're pretty juvenile, but, you still work at it and there's some connection. You feel that. It wasn't until I got to graduate school and, interestingly enough, I went to Northeast Missouri State. It's called Truman University now. They had for their teaching assistants, they had a program. Instead of putting all the teaching assistants in a bullpen and, you know, not having interaction with anyone else, they would put you with two professors so you could learn how a professor interacts with students and get sort of firsthand knowledge what it was like really to be a professor. So it was a great, by accident, great program. And I got put in a room with two poets, professional poets. And so it really helped. And interestingly enough, you come in, you're bright eyed and you don't know what to expect. And the two poets, they said, well, we're working poets and here's how it is. You have to write every day and you have to write something good enough once a week to be able to send out to a publisher. So I said, well, I've got classes and I have things I have to do. They said, no, that's no excuse. You've got to write every day. So it was very good discipline early on, and they're both great poets and a lot of publications, and so it was a good experience for me. And I think after that I started going back and looking at some of the experiences I'd had in the past. A lot of my poetry is really rooted in place, a strong sense of place, and so I could go back and look at my early years or my early years teaching right out of college down in the small town in the Ozarks, and I was able to really connect in a lot of that and turn it into poetry. So it's kind of what got me started and helped me go along the way. Another thing, though, too, was interesting, this whole world of poetry and writing. Ironically enough, it was a poet from Northern Illinois University who came to visit to read, Lucian Strike. And he came and was giving a reading, and I'd never heard a professional poet read before. And it just opened my eyes. It was amazing to hear that. And it gets you pretty excited about it.
Now, you said those two professors. What were their names?
Jim Barnes and Andy Grossbart. Jim Barnes has done, he was an interesting background, Choctaw Indian in Oklahoma, was a lumberjack for 10 years, decided to go back to school, got a PhD in comparative literature. He probably has a dozen books of poetry, a lot of awards and so on. And we still stay in touch. He's still a published poet. Andy has passed away, but he was a very vibrant poet. And he was studying under Richard Hugo and who studied under Theodore Retke. So there's all this lineage too, you're sort of first part of and getting to hear a lot of that connection.
Now, you said they had you writing every day and then sending out to a publication once a week. Has that slowed down for you?
Oh, yes, it has. I write poetry when I'm inspired and because I want to work on something. I'm not a full-time working poet. I admire those people who spend their time and they really master the craft and work at it. And as I said, I got a lot of respect and admiration for them. I'm more of a poet who works on something when it comes to me. And I think it was Jim Harrison who said, when God gives you a poem, you better write it. So that's kind of how I approach it.
I'm smiling because I want to say the last episode I did with someone, they were talking about how poems come to you and how you have to be disciplined enough to write it. And we were talking about, yeah, they'll come and you think, I have this young mind. I'll write that later when I get a chance. And then it goes away. So just that, hearing that message, this is like the second or third time I'm hearing that message. It's gonna make me take some
Might
time
mean,
and go to the library and just get it all out.
it might mean something,
Yeah, it might. Now, I want to talk about some of the work that you've done in regards to highlighting other poets and their books. When did that type of work get started for you and why?
Well, in graduate school, I've always wanted to, I've always sort of been on this. In college, I probably read more things that weren't on the syllabus than things that were on the syllabus. And I've always been like that, where I'm kind of venturing off the main road. In graduate school, we had to do a master's thesis. And I didn't want to just do another long essay on, Hemingway and his image of women, or, somebody's theory of the city in poems. And so I wanted to do something different. So this is back in the 70s, and concordances were always done manually, just hard labor, someone sitting down, recording line by line which word is in it. There had just been a few concordances that were done computer aided, and I decided, well, I'm going to do that. They didn't know what they were getting into when they gave me permission to do that for my thesis, but I had to find a poet who had few poems. Because in those days the computers couldn't handle much, and I selected Wilfred Owen, the British World War I poet, and he had about 80 poems in his collection since he perished during the war. So I went through that whole process, and part of it was learning how to do a computer-aided concordance. We had to find a computer big enough. In those days it was an IBM 360, and they had to unload everything off the program, run mine over the weekend, took a whole weekend just for 80 poems. You could probably do it on your cell phone now. And so that's how I got started sort of doing things a little bit different. And then through over time, I found that even in addition to my poems, to writing essays, writing a few book reviews, things like that. And so it worked. And the book we're talking about today, it would have been 20 years ago, City Lights was coming up to their 50th anniversary of the Pocket Poets series. And I thought, well, that's an appropriate time to exhibit my collection and also write essays on each of the books. And so that sort of started. One thing leads to another.
So for our listeners, explain what City Lights is.
Yeah, City Lights is, of course, a renowned bookstore formed by Lawrence Ferlinghetti and a partner. So 72 years ago, as hard as that is to believe, Ferlinghetti went to San Francisco and started the first paperback bookstore ever. And it was called City Lights. He was a veteran from the war. He was a skipper on a sub chaser. He was at D-Day, finished his service over in the Pacific Theater. And after school, after the war, he went over to France and studied at the Sorbonne, and came back and didn't want to be around the whole New York scene. He's a painter, but he's also very much a poet at heart. He went to San Francisco, opened the bookstore, and after 2 years, he took it over completely. And he decided, well, I'm going to get into publishing too. And so he thought, well, how am I going to do this? He thought, well, I'll publish my first book of poems myself. And so he wrote Pictures of the Gone World, published that through Pocket Poets. And he designed these books, the Pocket Poets, to fit. They're like 5x6. They were meant to fit in the back pocket of a laborer or a guy on an assembly line or somebody working out in the field, where he could take out every day and be close to poetry. And so Ferlinghetti was very, very cognizant of that, and was going to design his books to do that. And they started the Pocket Poets series. Appropriately enough. And his book was highly successful. He was surprised by it, but he got a lot of recognition for it. New Directions became his publisher then for all of his future books. Another book he's written called Coney Island of Your Mind. At one point, it was the largest selling poetry book in the world, and it may still be today. So Ferlinghetti started this, and the series was at first, he did a few books of of Rex Roth Patchen, people from the San Francisco scene who he admired, expanded a little bit into the beat poets. It's most famous because of he published Howl by Allen Ginsberg. And of course, once the trial came up for the obscenity trial for the book, and then once it was recognized that it was not found obscene, and that opened up everything, a lot of popularity, and it started moving forward. And over the years, he wrote, he did a few translations. One of the early books he did was Prévert's poems from France. That's an interesting story. In 1944, when he was over in France, he was in some little village at a cafe, and he sees a poem scrawled onto the paper tablecloth. And he thought, this is great. And he really liked the poem. It was by Prévert. Prévert was a very popular poet, sort of a Whitman of France, if you will. And so who knows if Prévert really wrote it himself or someone else, but that makes a good story anyway. And so he did his translations early on. He did Denise Levertov, Ginsberg, Kerouac, Corso, Duncan, just went through the years. Within about 10 years, as he became more popular with his poetry and he was starting to travel, and he was always a very socially activist person, and he would be in South American countries that were facing revolution, or he would be in Europe, and he started doing more and more international voices. So he would do people from the South American countries, from Mexico, and so on. Within 50 years, when I did the book, he had already amassed 56 different poets, had Pocket Poet Series. So it was very prestigious to be in that group, and quite an accomplishment. There's no other poetry series that's run that long. And so that's a little bit about him. And so I, when I did that book, I tried to just give a short summary of each book, just so people get a flavor for it. It's not a critique of the poetry. It's not a review. It I always described as sort of an annotated bibliography, only very informal. So a little bit about the poet, an anecdote about what might have happened when they pressed the book. Robert Bly was giving his anti-war speech. Ferlinghetti heard him give that speech and said, "Well, let's make that a pocket poet." Things along that line. And so here we are, 20 years after the book that I did in 2005, and it's the 70th anniversary. And I thought, well, I ought to really cap that off and follow up with that. So this is when we did this book. It covers the last 20 years, but there are only eight poets or eight volumes have been added in 20 years, as opposed to 56 in the first 50 years. So I had the luxury of doing a little more description. I dedicated full page, 250, 260 words to each poet. And once again, the same format of trying to just tell a little bit about the poet, a little bit about the book, to get people who aren't familiar with the series interested in these poets, because it's a very eclectic group. If you read one, you may not ever cross the other one. And then also to anybody who's familiar with the series to say, yeah, I kind of pulled away for a few years. Maybe I better take a look at it again. So once again, it's I described as sort of an annotated bibliography with a nice touch. The introduction, I tell how I started the series and met with Ferlinghetti in his offices back in 2001. And so it's been a good journey, as I say. So if you want, I could walk through these and give you a feel for the poets.
Sure. I don't know as far as what you can share, what they've given you permission to share, but if you want to talk about the poets and give me a little bit of information about what your thoughts are about their works, and then we'll get into some of your work.
Oh, sure. We can share any of this. This is nothing. It would be no different than you writing an essay about a poet or an author. And so there's nothing that but I did work with City Lights, and they know I put the book together, and so there is that from a permission standpoint. But the first book is number 57 in the series, and then this is a Camus Daoud. He is a poet in Los Angeles, and The Language of Saxophones is his book. His book is interesting because it's a collection of poems from over the years from 1970 to 2005. So it gives a real good sense of the poet's history, his development, how his poetry has changed, and so on. He calls himself a griot. So he's a the Western African storyteller, if you will. He's a very big in community and reading, teaching in the community, and so on. And he's his poetry is very much based in jazz. He's done a lot of recordings with jazz. In fact, there's an excellent CD of his called Lemert Park, which is a location in Los Angeles. And he's very committed to that. Interestingly enough, Camus and I, we've talked a few times, but interestingly enough, he was, and this is kind of a long story, but it's interesting. He was early in his career, probably when he was a teen, he was in the Watts Writers' Workshop. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but the Watts, they call them the Watts Riots, but really it's the Watts Uprising in 1965. And he after that, one of the Hollywood producers, Bud Schulberg, went into the community and it was just devastated and said, we've got to help everybody rebuild. And he set up a creative writing workshop building and everything just so the young people could get involved, express themselves, get out some of their frustrations and so on, and turn it into writing and through writing, mainly in poetry. Wanda Coleman's one of the people who was in that. The poet Wanda Coleman, she was in that group. But Camus was at, this is kind of a strange twist of fate or irony. Here I am, a young middle class, a suburban white kid from Southern Illinois in 1965, and we decided to go on a family vacation to California to visit my uncle who lives in Los Angeles. We're there playing miniature golf during the day and all the regular tourist stuff you do. And that night, the riots broke loose. So there's fires, you can see them in the distance, you can smell the smoke, sirens going all night. And it was, for me, obviously, it was something pretty eye-opening. I'd never been around anything like that before. And most people, it was very devastating for the community, very hard on him. And here, 60 years later, Camus, who was part of that writing group that came out of that riot, here I am, and we're doing something in a book together.
That
I
is
don't know.
interesting. The fact that
That's
you
pretty
just happened to be
poetic.
visiting California when that took place. Wow.
I know it was strange. And so, but he's a great poet. Like I said, he's got quite a bit on CD. All of these people have quite a bit nowadays in the internet world where you can almost plug in their name and hear a recording of them reading. The next person would be number 58, and this is Christina Rossi. She's from Uruguay. And back in the early 70s, and remember, Ferlinghetti is very much in tune with revolutionary times and people suffering through social injustices. And so in 72, she was a professor and a well-known author in Uruguay. And when the military coup took over, she lost her professorship and she was censored, couldn't write anymore. So she self-exiled, left, and went to Spain. And at the time, as like any good writer, she wrote poems every day and collected in her diary and so on. And for 30 years, she never published those poems of that first year in exile. A few years, well, this is in 19, 2008. So about 2003, 2004, she decided to go ahead and publish them in another language. This is the first English language. It's a bilingual edition, but the first time her poems have been translated into English. And a lot of, as you would expect, thoughts and feelings about isolation, separation, and trying to find a new home. But it's interesting. The other thing that makes this book interesting is her translator was Marilyn Buck, and she herself is a person in isolation here in America. She's passed away now, but she was a revolutionary during the 60s, involved with, I don't know, SDS or some of those revolutionary groups. Eventually, she was sent to federal prison for her part in bombings and some of those things. She ended up doing the translations for this. So she considers herself in exile as well within here in America. And so she had a real connection with Rossi. So it's a very interesting book, very good book for someone to feel that. So you can see how that's different already from Daoud's book. The next one is number 59 in the series. And this is Philip Lamantia, his book Tao. It's again, he is a very well-known poet in the San Francisco Renaissance period, early surrealist poet. In fact, he was a surrealist when he was a teenager. His background, he was in Christian Brothers School, and he had a wild Scottish or Welsh teacher named Griffin, blazing red hair. And he taught English classes, and he said, "You can either do homework every night or write a poem." And Philip Lamb Matthias said, "I'm going to write a poem every night instead." So he ends up writing a poem, gets very involved with it, models a lot of his poems after Edgar Allan Poe and some of the early writers. Sent his stuff off to the Surrealists in France. They liked his work. When they exiled into New York, he met a lot of them. So early on, as early as 16, he was being a published poet. He's also well known for he was one of the readers at the Six Gallery reading in San Francisco. If you're familiar with that, San Francisco Renaissance had been going on. The Beat generation or the Beat poets showed up out there. They had a reading at the Six Gallery in October of 1955. That was the first reading Ginsberg did of Howell, and that's how it put it on the map. Philip was the only published poet that night of the six people reading, and he chose not to read his own poetry. He was going through a spiritual reawakening, put his own material aside, and read the poems for his good friend John Hoffman, who had passed away in Mexico, and he read his poems instead. So, come full circle, after Philip passed away, when they're going through all of his papers, they find a manuscript of poems written during that period. Title page, everything's prepared, copyright page prepared, never got published. So, these poems are sort of a lost book that would have been during that same period. So it's again an interesting background on his. But his poems are very much surrealistic in nature and structure. Fourth person in this in the book that I did is number 16. This is David Meltzer. His book was called When I Was a Poet. David is a interesting fellow. He came out of New York. He was a child performer, played guitar, read poems on television back in those days in the early 40s. His family moved to Los Angeles, and he got involved in a lot of the art scene down there, continued to write poetry. A lot of people from LA started hearing that San Francisco was the place to be, and they migrated up there. And he did the same, learned early on, studied under Rex Roth. With Jack Spicer, Duncan, some of those people. So he was there for the pre-Renaissance, the Renaissance period. And then once the Beats hit, he sort of was in that group. After the Beats left in the late early 60s, he stayed. He became involved in the emerging 60s scene. So he's covered a lot of periods, very much rooted in his poems are rooted in discussions about family, friends, neighborhoods, people. Who are involved in the different artists over the time. He was invited to read at a house party, like a rent party. And that night in the audience, one of the guests was Ferlinghetti. Ferlinghetti heard him read his poems and said, "It's pretty good stuff." So he contacted him and said, "Why don't you put together a book of poems for me and let's put it in the Pocket Poets series." And thus, that's how he made it. He'd already done some editorial work for them. He had written been an editor for a few anthologies that they'd done, but this was his first poem after all these years of getting his poems in the Pocket Poets series.
Now, I'm going to take a moment before you talk about the other four because I want to give you some time to share with the listeners your poems. Then we'll get back to the rest of the other four in the book.
Sure. Do you want, would you like me to read something?
Of course.
Oh, okay. I've got some very rural poems, or I've got some contemporary poems.
Whatever you think you want to share with our listeners is fine with me.
Here's a poem that I started off, and how poems evolve or anything evolves over time. I began this originally thinking about when my granddaughter was going to go off to college. And she was going to New York, so moving from a small town of Rockford to a big city of New York, and she was always a pretty independent person. And I just sat down and the poem came to me pretty easily. I ended up adapting and changing it to a more general public. And it's, I think, what a lot of us face with, whether we're leaving because we want to, because we have to, just the uncertainty and the the unknown, but also the excitement of what's going to happen. So it's simply called leaving. So you're leaving now, a promise made many times, your bag with clothes, a good luck charm, a book or two. Is there room for bitterness, for regret? There's only one window in your room. It looks onto a new world. It shows your reflection at first, then the blue light sky and beyond. From your window, you can see a nearby square, a singer-songwriter with guitar trying to be heard, readers and writers solitary in labored work, a young couple holding hands in their own world. From your window, you can see bridges like spiders weaving into nearby worn neighborhoods, born again and again. Rooms with old couples sharing a soup, young mothers humming a melody to a first child, video game playing boys in endless wars. From your window, you can see beyond the land, over a span of water, easily traveled if you close your eyes. Places with familiar names, Paris, Milan, Tangier, with exotic stories to tell. There are unknown places, small villages, old men lined on wooden chairs remembering youth, aproned women sharing a sad laugh. Places you've never visited, places so poor there are no possessions, places where a stranger's visit becomes a story to be told and retold. From your window, you can see where you will leave a footprint, where you will go day by day, where you will learn a new face, a new song, a strum on the heart. From your window, you can see the blue light sky and beyond.
That is lovely. I love the how you use the focal point of the window to tell so many small stories. You covered so much there. Now you have to tell me, what was your granddaughter's response when she heard or read this poem?
Oh no, I think she was very much, a pretty emotional response. And there's a lot of bravery in going off into the world. And I think that it meant a lot to her. And it's been whenever she's heard it again or read it again, it's a keeper from her standpoint.
Now, is she still in New York or is she?
She's graduating in a few next month from NYU. She's in nursing and she's already landed a job at the Cleveland Clinic. So she's moving along. Well, it was a good experience for her.
I know she's going to cherish that poem. Do you have another one that you want to share?
Sure. I've got something in the same vein, I guess.
I love writing poems for family members.
That's very difficult to do too.
I
A
love it.
friend of mine who's a poet, he said, be careful, writing personal poems can be tricky. This is a poem called Camped Below Bat Cave. And I'd mentioned earlier about my years down in the Ozarks. Right out of college back in the 70s, it was hard to find a job. I got a job in a little small town of 150 people and the public school there that served the whole surrounding area. And my wife and I were young, just right out of college. And it was an hour from the nearest city. And we of course, it served the whole community. I even drove a school bus. It's very, very country like, very Missouri Ozark. But I learned a lot in those 2 years before I went to graduate school. And there was one of the things for entertainment was pretty difficult around there. But on Friday nights, people would drive down to the rivers and park on the gravel bar there. And at night in the summer, there's a cave, a big opening up there, and for lack of creativity, they just called it Bat Cave. And there are all kind of legends about Bat Cave. And at dusk, bats would just come out in a big cloud and swoop over the river. And they say in the old days, it used to come out a black cloud almost darken the sky. But over time, it published. And there were legends. You'll hear about some of those in there. Bat fertilizer is very valuable. People would go in and do that. There's legends of bank robbers burying treasures in there and so on. So that's what inspired me on this, but it was a very, as I said, sense of place. It meant a lot to me. It's called Camp Below Bat Cave. The sun slows, pushes the tops of trees across our camp where the Osage and the Big Tavern break. At dusk, the cliffs turn dark. Brush fills the pocked gray stone. The bleak sky announces a cave's single socket that scans the Osage bank for lost Indians and steam goats that never pass. They say a fortune was made when a fertilizer company moved in trucks and conveyors, scraping the belly of the cave for its strange gold until they uncovered bones. All digging stopped. Nothing remains except a gutted truck and a chain of rusty mining carts. 10 years ago, we could have seen bats exit the cave and rise up like a quick, dark cloud of sudden Missouri storm. Now, only a few weak wings dive for smaller river creatures. Most are hidden deep within the cave in tunnels that wind through limestone deep into Missouri's granite bones.
Your sense of place is impeccable. I mean, you take with each of those poems, you took me there. Like I felt like I was standing there looking around. So great talent with that.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, now we can go back to the book and let's talk about the other poets. I just wanted to make sure that we highlighted some of your work as well.
That's great. Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it. It's always good to be heard. So as we move through the next group, and this would have been this poems came out in 2017. As I said, there were only eight done in the last 20 years, and there's no set schedule. It's when the talent is there, they'll put them in the series. And this is by a great fellow, Tongo Eason Martin. His book Heaven Is All Goodbyes. Tongo is a interesting fellow, tall, nice, quiet, soft-spoken guy. San Francisco, lived in San Francisco his whole life, very much tied to the community, very activist socially, understands the community needs, gentrification that took place there, mistreatment by police, over-incarceration, and so on. So Tongo's a good guy, but he's got 2 degrees from Columbia University, very well spoken. And his poetry, too, is also very jazz style. Good, the syncopation and the accents and so on, very much in tune with jazz greats. And a lot of these poets, Daoud and Eason Martin, give credit to the poets, give credit to the jazz musicians, poems dedicated to them and so on. And he's won a number of awards. He was poet laureate for San Francisco for a 3 year period from 21 to 22, so that's, I guess, that gets started with him. He is one of the few poets who's had two books. Only six poets have had two books in the whole Pocket Poet series. So a few years later, they did a second book as he continued to win awards and came up, continued to write. Again, this one's called Blood on the Fog, and very much more, a little bit deeper, a little more revolutionary tone in his voice. And he's got some, again, connection to, I'm looking for a poem, let's see, to give you a feel. Just the opening for a poem called Four Walls. A lot of God can happen in 3 seconds. Not much heaven, though. Here is a man before a fight, leave me alone type character, emerging from the penniless death of a one-way street fiction. I mean, I'm going to make it, even if I have to drive backwards. So he's got that, and he understands you very much in touch. Great guy. I saw him read in Milwaukee a few months ago now, and afterwards we went up, he and I started talking, and I had learned that he had recently moved to Detroit. So we talked a little bit about that because his partner got a job at one of the universities there, so he moved, and he's being a writer, he has more flexibility to move. But he was so deep in sense of place. We talked about that with San Francisco scene and the people there in the communities, you know, the kind of adjustment that he must be going through. Of course, in the middle of winter, you aren't out on the street and meeting people and moving around. We talked about that. I asked him about his little girl and had a a daughter who was under 2 years old and ask how she was doing and that. And we're talking. I'm saying, oh, it must be, I'm thinking very heavy poetic terms about, oh, it must be difficult trying to get a new sense of place and community and connecting to all that. And after 30 years in your other community, and he's going, yeah, it's really hard. And just, boy, just even trying to get sleep and stuff. And I said, really? I said, it's that it is. I said, I'm sure you'll adjust pretty soon. And he looks at me and goes, what are you talking about? And he said, well, I was talking about poetry. And he goes, I'm talking about my little one keeping me awake at night. So it's pretty good. It's just that little human connection. Sometimes we forget that we all have things going on. Even famous poets have
Yeah,
day-to-day life.
but to your credit, poetry can keep you up. I've
Yeah.
woken, I've jumped out the bed like, where's my pen? Because the line was in my head. It's like I'm laying there and then the poem starts rolling across my mind like the credits of a movie, and it's like, oh, I gotta get that. And
Yeah.
sometimes I miss it because I'm like, oh, I'll get that when I wake up. And then I wake up and say, what was
Yeah,
that?
that's fair. I said, well, wait till she starts talking, then you'll have holdings. But I've seen some of his videos where he's reciting his poetry and having her play on a drum and stuff. So
Oh,
he's
wow.
a great dad. And it's just sort of those little human anecdotes. But a very good poet. You're going to see a lot more of his name. He just received a big award from Yale that affords him time to write without any obligations of presentations or lectures or anything. And so we'll continue to see his name as time goes on. Number 63 is Will Alexander. Again, another poet who he's Los Angeles based, been writing for 20 years. And in fact, what's funny, last year his book of poems was a runner up for the Pulitzer Prize for poetry. And when we were talking, I said, isn't it interesting? You've been writing for 20, 25 years, and all of a sudden, boom, people have an interest in what you're doing and you're getting bigger publishers. And he said, yeah, just kind of interesting on this. He is very much, I call him pretty complex. He writes, he draws from a lot of different sources. He's a surrealist poet. So his poems may contain items on physics, art, travel, other poetry, jazz, and he's good at that. And we talk a lot. I like to talk about influences. And he talked about when he writes, he will often go ahead and play the music of John Coltrane. In fact, the title of this is "Divine Blue Light" for John Coltrane. So it's very much part of his light. And he says it's a long 50-minute solo, the longest solo that Coltrane does. And it's on one down, one up, one down, at the half note in New York back in the 60s. So he'll use that to get going. And once his mind starts racing, he just sort of gets into his phase of writing, which was interesting to hear that. And I always like to talk to poets too about their influences. And he talked about a number of influences that he had, but in particular, Bob Kaufman, the street poet from San Francisco. And Kaufman, of course, comes up in all three of these Daoud's and Ethan Martin's poetry as well. Bob Kaufman, in case you don't know, he was born in New Orleans in the 30s, was a street poet in New York in Manhattan, very well regarded, moved to San Francisco, and didn't write things down. He would write his poems on a scrap of paper. He was more of a, he'd show up at a cafe or down the street just reciting poems. And very well regarded by everyone. In fact, he said when they were younger, they would drive up to San Francisco and just wander around, hoping they could see a Bob Kaufman sighting. And so here he is later on in life, and he was telling me about he was working with Lamantia, who and someone else on editing some of Bob Kaufman's poem for a publication. And he said, Don, he was in the same building we were in. I said, really? I said, did you meet him? He said, no, but he was in the other room. And he said, just his presence there meant so much. So that was kind of interesting to hear that. But yeah, influenced by a lot of different poets, a lot of different personalities in his poems, and a good poet as well. I think being nominated as for Pulitzer Prize puts him in a pretty good category, and we'll see more of him as well. And the most current one, number 64, this just came out in 2025. So these are the eight poets who were included in this volume that I just put together. And Nasir Rabah, he is a Palestinian poet, and he is well recognized over there. He'd never had anything published in the US. Only recently he's starting to have poems. I know Atlantic did one of his poems and so on. City Lights is the first publication of a book of poems of his. And in the Pocket Poet series, it's bilingual. And he is a very well respected poet there. And he is from Gaza. And so that gives, I think, a lot more firsthand experience. A lot of his early poems are based on family, day-to-day life, mythology, and things that take place. The last half of the book focuses on poems that were written since the bombing started after October. And he is very much, conscious of that and cognizant of that in his poetry. And it comes through. The translators say they might not hear from him for 3 or 4 weeks. No communication, couldn't get, all of a sudden they'll hear from him. So he's right there. And his fat house, in fact, was blown up during one of the bombings. Lost everything, his library, everything. He goes to his house and, looking through the rubble, trying to find any remnants of anything, digs through in his library. He sees a book, pulls out a book, dusts it off. It's his copy of War and Peace. And
Wow.
that just gives you chills,
That's
doesn't it?
ironic. Yeah.
And
Wow.
so he's enjoying. They just did a book release of his book last week at City Lights. So he's starting to get a little bit of notoriety here in the U.S. And so that's the group of people I put together, right? I just went off of their lead and talked about these eight poets, trying to give them some recognition and sort of put a cap on what we did earlier, 20 years ago.
Now, what was that process for you? Like, how long did it take for you to read the books and actually do the part that you did?
Well, that's a real good question too. Reading the material is, you give it a first read. Then you go back and you've marked some of the poems, and you go back and take a look at them again, and you start picking up more each time, as you know, when you read poets, and you try to get a feel for what they're doing. And the other thing I have to do is some of these are 20 years ago, so I have to put myself in that mode. Like when Dawood was writing about things, even in Los Angeles and even in our world today, 20 years ago, things were very different in 2005 than they are today. So when I'm writing this, I'm trying not to be a critic, trying not to be a an essayist on their work. I'm just trying to be more factual. So you have to remember not to, every once in a while, I'll slip in critique or positive notes and, oh, what a great part this is. And I have to back away from that and realize what I'm trying to do is just give people an archival picture of the book or of the poet. And so that's one thing I had to be cognizant of. Even on the first volume, I tried to contact as many poets as I could. Even if I talked to them just once or twice briefly, a lot of them I met in person, and I wanted to do the same thing on this case. So we just talked by phone. Alexander, we only talked by phone. Dave Meltzer, he passed away, but I had quite a few conversations with him when he was alive. Lamontey was gone, and Rosie, I tried to get a hold of her in Spain, but that was difficult. Couldn't get through her publishers or anything. And of course I met Tongo, Ethan Martin in person. So yeah, you try to get a feel for them in a sense. And because part of what I write is not just about that book of poems, it's trying to get a little sense of the person and a feel for them as well. So that's another part of it. The other thing I found that was challenging was trying to, this time in the first book, some of the poets I can only dedicate one or two sentences to, because for 57 poets, I had to be more cognizant of my page space and time and so on. And in this case, I started off knowing I was going to dedicate a full page to each one, and with a cover, a copy of their cover, an image of their book cover on the facing page. So I kind of had the book design all in mind when I started. But then I still found myself having to edit quite a bit to keep it down to 260 words. And so some places I had to cut things I didn't necessarily want to, but in order to just stay disciplined with the process. I wrote my introduction which was pretty easy because I had a lot of feel for what I'd done. And so that's how it came through. Working with, I worked with a small imprint, one of the indie bookstores. I'm a big believer in supporting indie bookstores, trying to launch a press. And so Maze Books was trying to launch a press. So I published my book under their imprint. The first book was published under Grolier in New York. And so we worked with a local printer, and that had its own challenges. I went in saying, I want my book to look just like this first one. Well, they don't make that paper anymore, and they don't do this. And so self-publishing is a little different challenge, I think, than what you might face if you had someone else working with it. But it still was very good and a good experience.
Now, you mentioned Maze Books. I know that there is going to be an event tomorrow, but by the time this airs, that would have passed. By the time I produce this, that would have passed. So, but I want you to just give the listeners a brief description of what's going to happen.
Sure. This is a it's falling on what Rockford, their big art event of the year. It's Art
Art
Scene,
scene, yeah.
and they put a lot into that. There's, I don't know, 30 different locations where they show a lot of the art of local artists, young emerging artists, student art, people who have professionally done things. 2 years ago, Dave had just moved opened his bookstore at Maze Books at their new location, right down on the main street, on State Street. And it was the first night they were open. It was the first night of Art Scene. And he had me be the speaker that evening. And I did a program called Scene Beat. And I did sort of the history of the beats, the beat movement, through using a series of photographs that I had in my collection. So I would put them on a slide, and I did, I think, pulled 20 of my photos from then, sort of trust through the chronological history of the beats and the photographers who preserved all of that as well. So we did that for a launch. Dave's done other programs because they have a spring and a fall beat scene. And so this year it happens to fall on that again. I'm just going to talk briefly about the book and about these eight poets and their works. Everybody's going to be anxious to get out and see the other locations, so we'll do that. The next day, as you may know, is Independent Bookstore Day, and that's a big national movement, a big national process. So I'll come back that day too and sign books and be there for that.
Now, is there anything else you would like to share with our listeners, in regards to what you have coming up next?
I'm going to take a break from any big projects for a while, although I do have quite a few. Last year, I think I did two book reviews for publications, had some poems published, had I did an extensive interview with a fellow who was around back in '74 who'd been at a big beat event up in North Dakota. So most of my big projects are out of the way for right now. I've still got a few others. My wife is always kidding me about my big ideas, and so I think we'll see what happens. But yeah, I've got a few more articles coming up that I'll be working on.
Now, if there was one gem that you wanted to leave with fellow poets based on the works that you've read and all the work that you've done, what would that piece of advice be?
Well, I think the one thing we all need to remember as poets, fellow poets here, is, as you can tell, I'm a big admirer of Ferlinghetti. Lawrence Ferlinghetti said, "Poetry is the last lighthouse in a rising sea."
That hits home. Thank you so much for taking the time out to speak with me today.
Thank you very much.
And
I enjoyed it.
you have a wonderful day, sir.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Poetically Yours Extended Podcast. Catch Poetically Yours every Friday during Here and Now and All Things Considered on WNIJ. Listen anytime at WNIJ.org. Special thanks to the Nick Monte Trio Band for the smooth tunes you hear during this podcast. For Poetically Yours, I'm Yvonne Booz.